Move to my topic. Which will involve some. Okay, here we are. Okay. Today, I want to provide what you might want to think about as a recipe. Ingredients for the coming lectures, for the analyses, the theoretical questions, and the data. I'm going to start with the goals of the 10 lectures, and then go on to talk a little bit about what knowledge of language consists of in construction grammar as developed in Goldberg, 1995 and 2006. How can changes in knowledge of language be accounted for? And say a word or two about my data sources. After the break, I'm going to discuss or mention some basic principles of cognitive linguistics, some basic principles of construction grammar, and approaches to pragmatics in cognitive linguistics. Each lecture, including this one, will have a 5-minute break. And I plan to leave about 30 minutes for questions, comments, and challenges. I really do welcome challenges. I think research is dead if people don't challenge one another to think in different ways. So please feel free not only to ask questions, but to politely object to some things that I'm going to say. As you all know, cognitive linguistics is a perspective on the study of language that has as its subject matter language users, quotes, knowledge of the full range of linguistic conventions. Langacker said that in 1987. And Goldberg repeated it in 2003 and other times. So my main goal is to consider what this knowledge consists of. I will argue that this knowledge includes pragmatic knowledge and understanding of markers like all the same in thank you all the same. If I hear someone say thank you all the same, I know they are being polite. That's the thank you part. I also know that they have declined whatever offer it was because the all the same says, thank you, but no thank you. So one of the kinds of things that I'm going to talk about is how all the same came to mean what it currently means. I will consider how knowledge of certain linguistic conventions can be accounted for in terms of one model of cognitive linguistics, which is cognitive construction grammar, as developed in Goldberg, 1995 and 2006. So that's my main goal. The second goal, but almost as important, is to respond to recent calls to find principled ways of infusing more pragmatics, specifically conventionalized non-truth conditional meaning, into constructional thinking, and to show that discourse structuring markers, especially discourse markers, should be considered to be part of grammar and not extra grammatical. The third goal is to consider how changes in knowledge of language can be accounted for in terms of diachronic construction grammar. One approach is called constructionalization, and I developed that with Graham Trousdale, whose picture is there. I will introduce this perspective and some new thinking about what constructionalization and constructional changes are. And this new thinking is partly in response to our own concerns about what we said 8 years ago, and to what some other people have suggested were problems and critiqued the book. So we welcomed those critiques and it helped us think in new ways. And I will introduce some of those new ways of thinking. I will exemplify the constructionalization approach by investigating the development of some discourse structuring markers from a historical constructionalist perspective. So the overarching goal, the umbrella, if you like, on these 10 lectures is an attempt to develop a coherent cognitive perspective on changing knowledge of an important but understudied aspect of language use, discourse structuring markers, like all the same, after all, but, and many others. So, as I said, Langacker and Goldberg have both said that the subject matter of cognitive linguistics is knowledge of the full range of linguistic conventions. What exactly does that mean? What in practice do these conventions appear to be in the literature that we read? Most of the examples, until recently, mainly have to do with event structure. How do we express motion and manner? This was a question that Len Talmy asked a long time ago and wrote a two-volume book about in 2000. For example, swim into the cave versus go into the cave swimming. So event structure is one of the well-known topics of cognitive grammar. Another one is argument structure. Goldberg spent a great deal of time talking about the ditransitive and its relation to other structures. An example of the ditransitive is 3A. Sue told Jane a story. There are three noun phrases there: Sue, Jane, and the story. In 3B, you find Sue told a story to Jane, and there you have a prepositional relationship, also with three arguments. In both cases, Jane is understood to receive the story. She heard it. In 3C, Pat loaded hay onto the truck, which caused motion. There again, there are three noun phrases: Pat, hay, and the truck. But that is always prepositional. You do not get Pat loaded the truck hay. And the fourth one under three is Bob squeezed the ball flat. That is a resultative. Goldberg has spent a great deal of time discussing the relationship between those four types of argument structure constructions. She's discussed how this ditransitive entails reception. If I gave you something, that entails that you received it. That is a pragmatic aspect of knowledge of language. Of course, it's not true of the refusal class. She denied him a kiss, where the pragmatics is he didn't get it. But there's little discussion of non-truth conditional meaning in the pragmatics in general, which is surely part of knowledge of language. I'm going to argue this is a very essential part of knowledge of language. Knowledge of linguistic conventions presumably consists of knowledge of how to use and understand non-truth conditional expressions like after all. In 4, they got married after all. I'm going to talk at great length about, after all, in the fourth lecture. But for the moment, let us very briefly think about what after all means there. How do you understand it? The normal interpretation, even in contemporary English, is they're not expected to get married, but nevertheless, they got married. Another meaning is the fact that they got married is my reason for saying this. That is a justification meaning. I am going to argue that knowledge of those kinds of interpretations is essential to understanding a language. All languages have various kinds of markers of that type. I will only discuss a limited set of discourse structuring markers. Those are things that connect one clause with another. Even if the clause isn't present, one can reconstruct it, as I just did. They got married after all, meaning they didn't expect to get married, or we didn't expect them to get married. Nevertheless, they got married. After all, there signals, cues that you, the listener, have to interpret some kind of clause, some kind of meaning that preceded. There are many other kinds of pragmatic markers that I won't discuss, like, well, I mean, you know, those have been discussed in great detail. That's not my topic. But they're the same type of expression. In talking about these kinds of expressions, I'm responding to recent calls to find principled ways of infusing more pragmatics into constructionist thinking. I'm particularly thinking about Finkbeiner's work. There is an issue of the journal Constructions and Frames, edited by Rita Finkbeiner, whose picture is there. And she, in her introduction, which is 2019b, distinguishes minus conventional pragmatics, which is what used to be thought of as pragmatics, and plus conventional pragmatics, the subject matter of my talks and of much historical work. An example she gives is the first one. Consider the different kinds of pragmatic knowledge associated with, do you have time for coffee? Answer, my train leaves at 8. There's nothing linguistically conventional in that at all. It's totally context dependent. How you understand my train leaves at 8, how you respond to the answer depends entirely on the context, which I will mention again later. It matters how soon 8 o'clock is. There's nothing linguistic there. It's simply the person answering says, my train leaves at 8, and assumes that somehow the person asking the question knows what time it is. So, yes, I have time for coffee if it's 7 or 6. No, I don't have time for coffee if it's 7:45. There's nothing linguistically conventional in that. This is something that one just infers from the situation. It's totally situation dependent. But if you think about the example I gave before, thanks all the same. The interpretation is dependent on something, but it's dependent on the linguistic context. It's dependent also in part on the situation, of course, but all the same has a meaning that is conventional in all the kinds of contexts in which it's used. Same is true of got married after all, or they got married anyway. They got married anyway. Again, like after all, usually means we didn't expect it to happen, but they got married anyway. It's usually a bit dismissive, like I've complained about it and I didn't want them to get married, but they got married anyway, despite what I wanted. And they got married, by the way, where, by the way, signals that what you just said is a kind of add-on to what preceded. All the same, after all, anyway, by the way, they are linguistically conventional. One has to learn the form meaning pairings or constructions. They are not fully context dependent. They are partially context dependent, yes, but not fully. So our knowledge of language includes, I would say, the linguistic conventions that are discourse structuring markers, a set of expressions that are usually used clause initially to cue the relationship between a prior discourse segment D1 and an upcoming one D2, discourse segment 2. They range from partially contentful and semantic and monofunctional, like instead, to mainly pragmatic and multifunctional, such as after all. And I'm going to show how we can tell what the difference is there. And I'm also going to show that they can constitute part of knowledge of language and should be considered to be part of grammar. Now, as I interpret them, discourse structuring markers include discourse markers. There's a lot of problems, which I will talk about in connection with terminology here. Schifrin, 1987, called a great number of pragmatic markers discourse markers. Since then, Fraser has suggested that discourse markers are connective markers. They always connect D1 and D2. He calls them S1 and S2, which is segment 1 and segment 2. Same idea. Where I differ from Fraser, and this will be discussed fully in lecture 4, where I differ from Fraser is that I treat monofunctional ones as straight up discourse structuring markers and multifunctional ones as discourse markers. Doesn't really matter that much. It's just a way of organizing material. But if you consider, after all, they got married and they got married after all. After all is a discourse structuring marker. And it is also multifunctional, and I'd like to call it a discourse marker. So after all, they got married is normally going to be understood as my reason for saying what I just said is they got married. When it's in final position, they got married after all, I'm likely to mean what I said before, they got married despite expectations. So it has multiple meanings, it is multifunctional. But when you think about all the same, there's no difference in meaning at the beginning and at the end of the clause. All the same, they got married, means despite expectations, they got married. They got married all the same, also means they got married despite expectations. So I think that knowledge of language includes knowledge that certain pragmatic markers, discourse markers, whatever you like to call them, are multifunctional. And other markers with similar kinds of function are monofunctional, and they're not quite the same because you don't have to know what differences in meaning there are, whether they occur at the beginning or the end or the middle of the clause. That's what I'm going to argue, and I will argue it in many, many lectures. So if that seems a bit strange, I'll come back to it. Discourse structuring markers are largely markers designed not only to demonstrate what relationship between discourse segments the speaker writer intends, but also to cue those relationships for the hearer reader and to negotiate meaning. They are essential, actually, in negotiation of meaning. That's why I feel very strongly that knowledge of language includes knowledge of discourse structuring markers. Language is not just a repository of structures, but a dynamic system which we can use to communicate and negotiate meaning. Discourse structuring markers are essential in conversation and in but occur all the time. Some are essential in writing. For example, instead, however, by the way. None of those is used extensively in conversation. But if grammars privilege syntax, they are often marginalized. For example, Huddleston and Pullum in their 2002 handbook marginalized them in chapter 15, which is almost at the end. And it's on coordination and supplementation. To them, they are supplements of some sort. Heine et al., 2017 and in press, calls them part of thetical grammar, not of sentence grammar. Sentence grammar is essentially core grammar. I'm going to discuss Heine's et al.'s view of thetical versus sentence grammar in lecture 5. So I'll come back to that point. Discourse structuring markers do not appear as a topic in any of Goldberg's or Croft's books, but they are worthy of consideration all the same. Now, moving on to the question, how can changes in knowledge of language be accounted for in construction grammar terms? As you know, a great deal of work on cognitive linguistics is synchronic. But there's been increasing interest in accounting for change because linguistic knowledge changes. My knowledge of English is a bit different from the knowledge that my parents had. And I'm sure you will find that yours is different from your parents or grandparents. Language users have to negotiate meaning as change occurs. Think about grandchildren talking to grandparents, teenagers who are seeking to be noticed, second language users seeking to communicate in the second language. Those are all reasons for language change. And as a historical linguist, one of my goals is to introduce some constructionalist ways of thinking about changes. The term constructionalization was used in Stale. It's not a term we have invented, so some people think we did. The term was first used by Ostia in 2004. One of the things about the way in which we use language is that we know that if you've got an adjective, you can turn it into ization if you're talking about some abstraction, like grammaticalization, optimalization, and all those terms. So I'm going to discuss the perspective of constructionalization in lecture two. For now, let me say that constructionalization is the development of a new form meaning pairing. It is distinguished from constructional changes, which are in part contextual modifications before and after constructionalization. I'm going to discuss all of that later. Just as I said, in some sense, collecting the ingredients of a recipe for thinking about discourse structuring markers in a construction grammar way. Theoretical ideas must, of course, be grounded in empirical evidence. My evidence is the rise of these discourse structuring markers. And my focus is on the decline that I've already remarked on from relatively contentful monofunctional uses like instead to relatively pragmatic multifunctional discourse marker uses like after all. My data are from English, but I hope that the way that I am suggesting that we work on markers of this type will be useful for any language whatsoever in which such markers occur. Where do I get my data? Historical work is inevitably based on written material. The corpora that I use are COCA, COHA, and EEBO. COCA is a corpus of contemporary American English covering the time period 1990 to 2019. As of March 2020, it consists of more than a billion words. That's a lot of words. Some of them are, quotes, spoken. But the speaking is not conversation. It is what I call public speech. Some of the spoken material is speeches that somebody gave. Some of it is interaction in television or radio broadcasts. So it's public because it's not the kind of casual speech that you get between family members. It is the kind of speech that you get in a public situation. COHA is the corpus of historical American English from 1810 to 2009. And that consists of about 400 million words. EEBO, Early English Books Online, covers printed texts, and this is important, printed texts from the 1470s to 1690s. It consists of 775 million words of printed texts. Those do include drama, they do include trial, they do include interaction, but of course they are always represented speech. As I'm sure all of you know, when you look at corpus data, it looks like this. This is a shot from COCA. Looking for by the way, the by the ways are down there in the middle and they're all highlighted. You get a little context before and a little bit of context after. And fortunately, you can click on the left-hand margin and you can get a much larger context, which is very valuable. But of course, when you look at material like this, it has almost no resemblance to the sources from which it came. There was no printing in England before 1476. And many, many manuscripts look like this. This is a story of Noah's Ark from about the year 1000. Hard to read. Illustrated. Very attractive. But if you were reading original texts, you're going to have to look for your examples. You won't just get them. You know that. You might wonder why historical texts that we have, at least for English, are very limited in register in the early periods. In the early periods up to about 1476, and printed arose, manuscripts were written on vellum, which is specially prepared cowhide. They were therefore expensive and time-consuming to produce. So only highly valued texts were written down and copied. There are some very interesting doodles and poems in the margins, but mainly what you get is religious homilies, which are sermons. You get historical reports. You get a lot of philosophy. And you will find that among the examples I use, there are many examples from philosophy and history. So our data up to about 1500, our data in English is quite restricted in register and genre. That completely changed when printing and paper became available. Early printed books were designed to look like manuscripts, but for the most part had fewer designs. This is a picture of Caxton's first printed book. No, this is not a picture of that, I'm sorry. Caxton first printed his book, The History of Troy, in 1473. It was printed in Germany, where printing started, with the Gutenberg press. And then Caxton came back to England and printed many books in England, starting in 1476, which included Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. And this particular version here, this picture of it, is a 1483 printing of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. The Canterbury Tales, you probably know, is a tale of Chaucer riding down to Canterbury with a number of other pilgrims and sharing stories on the way. That document there is among the texts that you can find in EEBO as part of the corpus search that you can do. Why did I bother to say all of that? It's because I want to emphasize that texts have extensive co-textual context. You can retrieve some of it, not all of it, in EEBO, COHA, and COCA. But most other corpora and data sources, like the Middle English Dictionary and the Oxford English Dictionary, do not give you co-textual context. That makes historical analysis difficult. So most of us rely on corpora that allow context to be searched and acknowledge with great thanks the enormous work that went into compiling. Now, at that point, I'm going to stop. Let's have a 5-minute break and come back. And then I'm going to be talking about the basic principles, as I mentioned at the beginning, basic principles of construction, grammar, and a variety of other topics. So let's come back in 5 minutes. Okay, let's get started again. I want to leave plenty of time for questions. I'm going to start with what you probably all know, because I think that they're important for understanding the historical perspective that I'm going to be presenting here. As you all know, construction grammar is a particular subtype of cognitive linguistics. So I start with some basic principles of cognitics, among the most relevant to what I will be talking about, or first, the subject matter of cognitive linguistics is language users' knowledge of the full range of linguistic conventions. I've mentioned that already, but that's because I think that this is truly important. Second, linguistic relationships are not invariably all or nothing affairs. It's not absolute plus minus. It's not an absolute distinction between semantics and pragmatics. There's a continuum. Linguistic categories are gradient without sharp boundaries. Now, Langacker has said in 1987 that the distinction between semantics and pragmatics, or between linguistic and extra-linguistic knowledge, is largely artifactual. Back in 1987, that was what people believed. As I pointed out earlier, since then, there has been increasing interest in the conventional meanings of pragmatics, which in some sense makes the distinction between semantics and pragmatics less clear than it used to be. But as we will see, because we're going to be talking about change from coded semantics to conventionalized pragmatics in many cases, there really does appear to be a distinct difference between semantics and pragmatics. Meaning is not fixed. There's meaning potential. This means that there's an essentially unlimited number of ways in which an expression can prompt dynamic cognitive processes, said Fauconnier in 2008. But this is obviously not true, just stated like that. Context grounds and restricts interpretation. We will never understand each other if there's a totally unlimited number of ways in which an expression can prompt dynamic cognitive processes. There are plausible processes by which new meanings arise, new meanings and new functions. Another basic principle is that there's no or very little innate linguistic knowledge. Blueprints for language are learned. Again, Langacker said that in 1987. That is the topic of Goldberg's most recent book, the 2019 book, Explain Me This. And another principle is that constructions are linked in networks. So be going to, meaning I'm going from here to there in order to do something, is linked to other motion constructions like walk, run, and modality, because part of it is purpose and intention. I'm going to visit my aunt, is I'm going somewhere with the intention of, with the purpose of visiting my aunt. So there is an inbuilt modality in that expression. Be going to future, on the other hand, is not linked to motion constructions. It's linked to other futures, tense markers, and modality. Irrealis, which is non-factual meaning, because it refers to a future that it's coming into being. It is not realis yet. Now, switching to construction grammar and to Goldberg's version of it, we should first of all say that there are several variants of construction grammar. Hoffman and Trousdale, in their handbook, emphasize that there are many different kinds. But I'm only going to be focusing on Goldberg's work, especially her 1995 book and 2006 book, and it is known as cognitive construction grammar. Excuse the typo there, there's an R obviously on the end of grammar. Goldberg assumes the principles of cognitive linguistics that I just outlined. She refined some, developed some additional ones. And there are 17 tenets in her writings that are going to be key to my analysis. First, knowledge of linguistic conventions consists of form, meaning, pairings, or constructions. Form and meaning are paired by a symbolic link. Form consists of at least syntax, morphology, and phonology. And meaning consists of at least semantics, pragmatics, and discourse function. Now, the features of form have the potential to overlap. And the features of meaning have potential to overlap. But the form and the meaning features do not overlap. And this is rather neatly summarized in a model, maybe very well known to you, that appears in Croft's 2001 book called Radical Construction Grammar. Now, this particular model is going to be very important for us. The construction is a unit. This is the, this is the outer box, right? The outer box here. That is the construction. Inside it, there's form and there's meaning, and they are linked by a symbolic link. But the form, as I just said, is of different types, properties, I'm sorry, that's again a typo, syntactic properties, morphological properties, and phonological properties. Each one of those is subject to change. And the meaning is complex. The semantic properties, pragmatic properties, and discourse functional properties. Any one of those can change. And the symbolic link between the form and the meaning can change. Now, some people have been concerned about that. They say, a form meaning pairing, a construction is a sign, it's a single unit in the sense of Saussure. But that clearly won't work if we want to account for change or if we want to account for other aspects of speakers' knowledge of language. Here is Bill Croft. In his model, discourse functional properties include the illocutionary force of an utterance in a particular context, such as statement, question, command, features of information structure, such as topic focus, given new background, foreground, evaluations, such as surprise, and I would add discourse marker functions, which I will discuss, such as elaboration, contrast, and digression. A second basic principle of cognitive construction grammar of the Goldberg type is constructions are stored in a constructional lexicon known as a construction, as a constructicon. She spells it constructicon in the 2019 book, just to clarify its morphological structure, like lexicon. In her earlier work, constructions are said to be of any size, morpheme, word, phrase, clause, or larger discourse. But in more recent work, she and Diesel have defined a construction as a pattern involving at least two meaningful elements. On the grounds, and this is mainly Diesel's ground, because lexemes as monomorphemic expressions are processed in very different ways from sequences of meaningful elements. That may be true, but it is impossible to uphold if you're doing historical work. What is now a word has in many cases once been a phrase, like yesterday, which was Old English yistern day, yesterday day, or a clause like goodbye, God be with you. My favorite example is Lord, L-O-R-D, Lord versus Lady. A Lord was a half word. He was a loaf guardian. That was a compound. Many of our words that are monomorphemic in modern English were once compounds or phrases. So we have to be able to think that words are constructions. Otherwise, we can't talk about the results of changes. So I consider constructions to be of any size, from morphemes of words to phrases, clauses, and larger sequences, just as Goldberg did in 95 and 2006. A third tenet is that speakers' knowledge of constructions is both item-specific and generalized or schematic. Therefore, constructions are various levels of abstraction. When speakers produce an utterance, constructions stored in the constructicon are assembled and unified in speech or writing, provided they do not conflict. She said that in a very, very short article in 2003, which is really valuable to read because it summarizes everything that she was thinking at that time. Admittedly, it's a while ago. But most of the things she says there are still part of construction grammar. Very well worth reading. Everything is in the bibliography, references, if you have the PowerPoint. So for example, why didn't you go? Very ordinary sentence in English. It's conceptualized as an assembly of, among other things, the micro constructions, why don't you and go? The more abstract event construction, someone goes for a reason. The abstract negation construction, the abstract interrogative construction, and past tense. Items like why you not go are called substantive microconstructions. But items like interrogative, negative, are abstract schemas that license particular constructions. So the interrogative may be realized by one or more of a rising prosody, why didn't you go? This is exaggerating there, the upward rise. Where constructions like why, who, when, and where, and subject, verb subject inversion, as in did you go? And these levels of abstraction are of several types. There's the construct, which is the actual utterance, like break the plate. A micro construction breaks something, which abstracts over utterances of break something. A sub-schema, verb transitive act, which licenses transitive verbs and object noun phrases. And even higher level schema, predicate construction, which licenses various verbs, noun phrases, adjectives, and adverbs. The language learner starts with item-specific constructs and generalizes over them at various levels of abstraction. And that can be shown in a tree that looks like this. If you're used to generative syntactic trees, you you read from the top to the bottom. But in this kind of tree, you read from the bottom to the top. The constructs are at the bottom, break the plate, fall down. The idea is that speakers come across these constructs and they generalize over them. And the result is some kind of unit in the head, which is a micro construction like break X. And you can generalize over break X by observing that there are EX and CX and a number of other verb X constructions. And that gives you a subschema, which is a transitive construction, and that is part of a much more abstract predicate construction. Now, this is going to be important when we look at change, because we're going to see how various constructs are conceptualized as micro constructions and subsumed into subschemas and schemas. It's going to be part of what I'm going to discuss in particular cases of discourse structuring markers. The fourth basic principle is that there's no strict dichotomy between lexical and grammatical constructions. They are on a pole or continuum. So lexical constructions like constructionalization, ditransitives like Mary gave me a scarf, are on the pole of content meaning, and grammatical constructions like present tense and possessive case are on the procedural pole, as are discourse markers. I don't know where that red is coming from, but it doesn't matter. So procedurals trying to figure out where that came from. Doesn't matter. Procedurals. These are constructions with procedural meaning. They guide interpretations in context and point hearers to particular, more or less schematic frames of interpretation for the utterance hosting such expressions. Procedurals include not only the typical grammatical markers like tense, aspect, modality, and case, but also discourse structuring markers, particularly discourse markers. So, well, but I think that the settling of accounts is important. Well signals that there's some kind of hedge, some kind of contrast coming up, but clearly signals a contrast is coming up. By the way, there's a difference being a member, an informer, for example, and a torturer. And by the way, there introduces an add-on, an addition, a digression, and pretends is used to pretend that the next thing is somewhat of unimportant. But if you look at the content of what is said there, you will recognize that the content is really a bit shocking and very important. And I'm going to spend some time talking about, by the way, next week, by the way, is used to appear to be dismissive and not unimportant. But it is often used as it is here, as a hedge. Something significant is coming up, and in fact, it's the most important thing. So a fifth basic principle in Goldberg's work is semantics, information structure, and pragmatics are interrelated, all play a role in linguistic function. This is represented in Croft's model, but in fact, as I've said, not much is said about pragmatics in most of Goldberg's work. Knowledge of language is usage-based and grounded in instances of a speaker's producing and understanding language. That is a quotation from Cameron Barlow in 2000. It also appears in Bybee. It appears quoted in Goldberg. It's absolute key to what I'm going to be talking about. Knowledge language is usage-based, but that term means different things to different people. And I should say that not all constructionalists adopt a usage-based model. For example, Boas and Zog in a sign-based construction grammar, and Michaelis also talking about sign-based construction grammar, do not adopt a usage-based model. Both Langenecker and Goldberg use the term and say that they use a usage-based approach. For Langenecker, usage-based refers to an approach that, to quote him, is maximalist, non-reductionist, bottom-up. And he contrasts this to generative grammar, which in his view is concerned with economy, generativity, and reductionism. So he means something very abstract by usage-based. For Goldberg, it also means something fairly abstract. It means that knowledge of language includes both items and generalizations at varying levels of specificity. For me, it means, based in linguistic data, grounded in what I've already cited, Kemmer and Barlow's instances of a speaker's producing and understanding language. This reference is cited several times, as I mentioned, in Goldberg. And her seventh tenet that is going to be important for what I'm talking about is knowledge of grammar is dynamic, can change over a lifetime. It can change over generations, it can change over geographic space and social space. The point is, knowledge of grammar isn't a fixed thing, it can change. Now, moving on to approaches to pragmatics. It seems to me that lack of attention to pragmatics in cognitive construction grammar is a bit odd, because pragmatics was central to the work of Fillmore and colleagues that led to Goldberg's work. Kay and Fillmore, as is well known, discuss the example, what's that fly doing in my soup? It's idiosyncratic, it has nothing to do with doing anything. I mean, the jokes about what's that fly doing in my soup, or it's enjoying the soup and various other things. But if somebody says that, what's that fly doing in my soup? They're not talking about what a fly is doing. They are implicating a negative attitude to the situation that there is a fly in the soup. Furthermore, they're using a pattern. What's X doing Y? And Kay and Fillmore in their 1999 paper say, whenever anybody says, what's X doing Y, they're implicating a negative attitude. That's pragmatic. Now, Eve Sweetser, in 1990, argued that a cognitively based theory takes not the objective real world, but human perception and understanding of the world to be the basis for the structure of human language. And this is similar, in my understanding, to Langenecker's view of cognition as construal. She developed a highly influential theory of polysemy based on metaphorical frames, in his book, 1990 book, called From Etymology to Pragmatics. So pragmatics is in the title. She starts the book with a historical account of why verbs like grasp and see have both physical and intellectual cognitive readings. So you can grasp a piece of wood and you can grasp concepts easily. You can see the computer in front of you, and you can also see, hopefully see what I mean. Switch's purpose is to show that metaphorical frames have a long history in Indo-European. I'm sure they do in Chinese as well. She focuses on threefold interpretations of modals, like may, causals like because, and connectives like so. And the three-way distinction she makes is probably familiar to you. Real world, socio-physical, epistemic, grounded in knowledge and belief, and speech act, grounded in the illocutionary act. And here's one of her examples. He heard me calling, so he came. These interpretations are what she cites in the book. The hearing caused the coming in the real world. Or at least I represent hearing as being caused in the real world. You see, he's deaf, but he came. So he heard me calling. Where so now, in this context, is interpreted as the signaling the knowledge of his arrival causes the conclusion that he heard me calling. And third example, here we are in Paris, so what would you like to do on our first evening here? And her interpretation is, our presence in Paris enables my act of asking what you would like to do. Now, her point is that although you could say that that is contextually dependent on real world understandings of various things, in fact, we know that many, many aspects of language, modals, causals, and markers like so, can be interpreted in three different ways. That's part of our knowledge of language. Much research drawing on Switzer's work has been conceptualized in metaphorical, but not pragmatic terms she was interested in. However, a volume that came out in 2019 of Constructions and Frames and edited by Finkbeiner is devoted to reflections on the role of pragmatics in construction of grammar. And that is quite essential to the thinking behind these lectures. Finkbeiner, in her introduction, suggests that there has been a mindset in cognitive linguistics that, to cite her, semantics deals with truth functional context invariant aspects of meaning, while pragmatics deals with meaning aspects that are derived from actual utterances via inferential reason, that is, with respect, with aspects that vary with context. And here she cites Grass. An example is, pragmatics is largely part of invisible backstage cognition with exceptionally sparse formal or symbolic marking. Fauconnier said that in 2008. I hope that by now, if you thought that, you have recognized that in fact, it's not exceptionally sparse symbolic marking, provided one pays attention to such things as discourse structuring markers. They are exceptionally frequent, actually, or there's a large number of them. Some of them you use exceptionally frequently, like and but. In the old view that Finkbeiner talks about, semantics is plus truth conditional and plus conventional. That conventional means it's shared across some community of speakers. Pragmatics, on the other hand, in this original view, or for Kunyers, is truth minus truth conditional minus conventional and context dependent. Most of the contexts are real world conversational inferences that arise on the fly. I've already talked about four. Do you have time for coffee? My train goes at 8 o'clock. One computes no if 8 is a few minutes away, and one computes yes if 8 is a couple of hours away. But there's nothing linguistic there to signal how to compute. However, there are many, many markers, formal expressions, which have conventionalized pragmatics, like so and by the way. As you know, logicians' view of and but is that both are minus truth conditional and minus conventional and therefore equivalent. But in language use, they do not mean the same thing. We get a much quoted expression, but me no buts. I don't think likely to hear and me and no ends. They do not mean the same thing. They cannot be used in exactly the same way. Now, Grice, it was back in 1957, firmly maintained the plus minus truth conditional divide, as discussed in Jaschult. That's how to pronounce that very weird connection of consonants, Jaschult. Jaschult, 2019, discusses how Grice proposed dealing with the problem of but by suggesting that it is associated with the generalized, conventionalized implicature of contrast. So he introduced the idea that I've been talking about, generalized, conventionalized pragmatics. Since then, a partial but still strongly debated picture has emerged that some pragmatics is conventional and needs to be learned. And Finkbeiner proposes a view of an enriched pragmatics and overlap between pragmatics and semantics of the following sort in table one. Semantics is plus truth conditional and plus conventional. No change there. Pragmatics is minus truth conditional and either plus or minus conventional. And I'm going to assume this model of semantics and pragmatics and focus on the development of plus conventional pragmatics. So to summarize the second part of the lecture, knowledge of the full range of linguistic conventions includes knowledge of pragmatics, and some pragmatics is conventional. What is going to come next? Tomorrow, I will address the question how a historical perspective can be used to account for changes in constructions and how conventionalized pragmatic interpretations may arise. But for now, I think it is time for questions, comments, and challenges.